Assalamu alaikum. You are listening to She Speaks Academic Muslimas. Today, we are going to be talking to Dr. Maha Nassar, who's an associate professor in the School of Middle Eastern Studies and North African Studies at the University of Arizona. She specializes in Arab cultural and intellectual history with a focus on Palestinians. Her book, which received a 2018 Palestine Book Award, is titled Brothers Apart, Palestinian Citizens of Israel and the Arab World. Today, we talk a little bit about the history of Palestine or Palestine, the ongoing Nakba or catastrophe, anti-Semitism as it relates to the Palestinian Liberation Movement, Hamas, and issues of human rights. I'm grateful to Dr. Nassar, who has so brilliantly given us a brief analysis of some of the central issues. Before we begin, let me remind you to please subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. Share with everyone you can to support a diversity of perspectives within the world we live in. Now, let's begin. Assalamu alaikum, Maha.
Wa alaikum assalam, Saba.
Thank you so much for doing this and doing it on such short notice.
My pleasure.
I know these are difficult times and I really appreciate you giving time to the podcast. I hope this podcast is informative to anybody who wants to learn more about Palestine. I'm just going to jump right in and ask you to just start at the beginning of the 20th century. Who lived in Palestine or Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century?
Great, thank you. Great question. So at the beginning of the 20th century, there were a little over 600,000 people who were living in Palestine. And when we say Palestine or Palestine, we're thinking about it historically speaking and geographically speaking as being from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River or the Dead Sea, sort of east and west. And then in the south, the Negev or Naqab Desert, up north to the sort of Litani River, which is today in southern Lebanon. So the geography of Palestine or Palestine is more or less consistent over the centuries. So who was living there in the early 20th century? You had about 650,000 people living there. About 600,000 of them were Muslim and Christian Palestinians, and about 50,000 of them were Palestinian Jews. So you had a demographic of about 80% Palestinian Muslim, about 15% Palestinian Muslim, and about 5% Palestinian Jewish. And then over the course of the first half of the 20th century, with the Zionist movement and the rise of Jewish immigration to Palestine, by the time you get to 1947, there's about 1.3 million Palestinians, Muslim and Christian, and about 600,000 Jews.
So I wanted to ask you about the Nakba, which happens around that time period as well. What is the Nakba?
So the Nakba is an Arabic word that means catastrophe, and it's the word that Palestinians use to refer to the events between November of 1947 and the end of 1948. During that time period, in the first half from November of 1947 until May of 1948, after the United Nations declared the partition of Palestine into a Jewish state on one side on about 55% of the land, and an Arab state on about 45% of the land, Palestinians rightfully feared that they would be ethnically cleansed from the areas that were designated as part of the Jewish state. And the reason they feared that is that the day after the UN declared its the partition plan, Zionist gangs, armed gangs, started going into Palestinian neighborhoods and towns and expelling Palestinians from their homes. And that continued throughout the spring months, winter and spring months of 1948, such that by May 14th, 1948, when Israel declared its independence, it had already displaced and expelled about 350,000 Palestinians from their homes. After Israel declared its independence in May 1948, through the end of 1948, there is what is sometimes called the First Arab-Israeli War, or the 1948 War, where you had several Arab armies that tried to prevent the expulsion of Palestinians. They weren't successful in doing so. So by the end of 1948 or early 1949, over 700,000 Palestinians had fled or had been forcefully expelled from their homes. And that is what Palestinians call the Nakba.
So that's a good primer for the creation of Israel and the, you know, the recent history for Palestinian people. And I'm going to jump to now today, mm-hmm. which we're going to talk about a little bit later as well, the conditions that Palestinians live under. But right now, I want to ask about how the Palestinian freedom movement is viewed in the United States, and how it is how people who support Palestinian rights are often characterized. I know that this time it seems just a little bit different, but not a whole lot. What would you say to the charge that supporters of Palestinian rights hate the idea that Jews live in a land that is historically important to them, that we are anti-Semitic, or that we want to destroy the only home and Jewish state that is known to Jewish people in the world?
That's a good question. And it's a charge that we hear often. So there's two ways that I would answer that. One is rooted in history and in Islamic history specifically. So many of us hear that Jews were expelled from Jerusalem by the Romans in the second century of the Common Era, 135 AD specifically. We forget the other half of that story, though, which is that when the first Muslim caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, and the Muslim armies opened Jerusalem and opened Palestine, one of the things that they did shortly after, one of the things Umar ibn al-Khattab himself specifically did, was invited 70 Jewish families who had been expelled previously and were living in Tiberias. He invited them back into Jerusalem to settle back into the city. And through that step, opening up the Jerusalem for Jewish worship. So from the time of the Islamic conquest, Jews have been able to live in Jerusalem, have been able to worship in Jerusalem, and have been supported in doing so for the last 1400 years. The only exception to that was when Jerusalem was conquered by the Crusades and ruled by the Crusaders. And when Salah ad-Din reconquered Jerusalem, reopened Jerusalem to Muslims, again, Jews were allowed to and invited to return to Jerusalem. So first off,
I just want to intervene and say Salahuddin is another Muslim leader here.
Yes, Salah ad-Din is another Muslim leader who in the 12th century, so the Crusaders ruled over Jerusalem for about 90 years from 1099 to 1187. Salah ad-Din reconquered Palestine and Jerusalem from the Crusaders, opened it up to Muslim rule. And this idea of opening that we have in Islamic history is the idea of opening, and it's part of the Quranic tradition, an Islamic tradition, which is to allow people, and especially Ahl al-Kitab, people of the book, to worship in their houses of worship. So historically speaking, under Islamic rule, Jerusalem and Palestine have always been open to Jewish worship and Jewish settlement. So that's number one. Number two, the Zionist movement as it emerges in the 20th century was never the political Zionist movement, because there are different strands. The political Zionist movement as it was enacted was never about living in Jerusalem or living in Palestine. It was about ruling over the territory, creating a Jewish state at the expense of the Christian and Muslim original inhabitants of that land. So then to answer your question more directly about the charge that supporters of Palestinian rights are somehow anti-Semitic or hate Jews or don't want Jews living there, historically that's inaccurate, but it's also grounded in, and I'm actually working on an article about this, it's actually grounded in a larger ethos of Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism that denies Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, denies their legitimate political claims. It tries to erase them and say, you don't have actual political claims. You don't have national claims. You don't have claims of justice. You are just upset and angry because you hate Jews. It's a deeply, deeply Islamophobic, has deep Islamophobic roots to that as well.
That's an excellent analysis. I can't wait until that article comes out so we can see it in print. And we often saw the same explanation in the United States when they talk about Islamic terrorism. Like, this is just what Muslims believe. They just hate us. They just hate our values. And that's their grievance against the United States instead of talking about American foreign policy or anything of that sort. So I do see a similar theme there. Can you also talk a little bit about, you know, Hamas? So one of the things that I often see when topic of Israel comes up with, especially with white audiences that don't know a whole lot about the issue that's going on, or even within Israeli circles itself, and they want to learn more. They want to see the Palestinian point of view, But they often end up talking about like how Hamas is throwing rockets, and if they can just stop throwing rockets, then we can have peace. So can you talk a little bit about how this focus on the Hamas rockets derails any discussion about human rights violation?
Sure. So you're absolutely right that there is this line that we hear often that if only Hamas would stop its rockets, everything would be fine. And we saw how inaccurate and wrong this was just this past month. For 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the very first Hamas rocket was launched on May 10th, for the 3 weeks leading up to that, every single night during Ramadan in Jerusalem, at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest Islamic site in Islam, armed Israeli soldiers were going into the area, harassing Muslim worshippers during their Taraweeh prayers and immediately after their Taraweeh prayers, harassing them, arresting them, beating them up. As the weeks of Ramadan went on, and as we moved into the last 10 nights of Ramadan, we started to see soldiers raiding the inside of the musalla, throwing stun grenades at worshippers while they were praying Qiyam al-Layl. So these are the kinds of things that led up to the first launch of the first rocket that happened on May 10th. So to say that if only Hamas stopped throwing rockets is to, number one, assume that there's no precipitating events. Number two, to assume that there's no political motivation or human rights motivation behind it. And number three is to obscure or ignore all of the human rights violations. And that's just in one place in Palestine during one particular moment in time. And then we can have another conversation about all the other Israeli rights, all the other Israeli human rights violations that happen as well. So Hamas is a symptom of the problem, not a cause.
And can you like focus a little bit on the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah as well, and what happened in that particular context in terms of Hamas's response?
Sure. So Sheikh Jarrah has a neighborhood in East Jerusalem. It's just to the east of the old city of Jerusalem. It was in the 1948 war. It was sort of captured and controlled by Jordan. And then after the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, it was occupied by Israel illegally. Israel annexed East Jerusalem and the old city, also illegally, according to international law. And in that neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, several Palestinian families who had been refugees had been made into refugees in 1948. The UN and the Jordanian authorities settled them in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the 1950s. So they've been living in those neighborhoods and in those homes since the 1950s, after they were kicked out of their original homes in what is now Israel, which happened in 1948. Now, Israeli settlers, and for a number of years now, Israeli settlers have wanted to quote unquote Judaize East Jerusalem. That's their word, not mine, right? They want to make it more Jewish and make it less Arab or less Palestinian. And so they use various legal tools and lawsuits, but they also use terror. I mean, they use brute force to terrorize the residents there so that they'll move out. So they'll sell their homes, they'll just leave. So the standoff in Sheikh Jarrah, which was also happening all throughout Ramadan and before that even, was Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah saying, "We're not leaving our homes." And their supporters saying, "We are not going to allow these Israeli settlers nor the Israeli state to continue to carry out ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, this Judaizing of East Jerusalem." So it became an international campaign, a nonviolent social media-based campaign, which also raised awareness about what was happening. And that also precipitated the escalation that we're seeing now.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, one thing that I often think about is when this Hamas charge comes up, is I often think about Angela Davis's quote on violence, which I don't have in front of me. But some reporter asks her as she's sitting in prison, like, what do you think of the violence committed by Black Panther? And she's like, "You're asking me about violence when so much violence has committed on my communities. You want to ask me what I think of violence?" Like it, I mean, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, to imagine all these precipitating events, to imagine what happened at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds and in Jerusalem, you know, and then to ask Palestinian people constantly, what do you think of Hamas's rocket? Like, what do you want me to do? Lay down and die?
You are absolutely right. And that is the answer that Palestinians, and especially Palestinians in Palestine, will give to that question.
Right. And Israel has one of the most powerful armies in the entire world. They have a dome of defense that prevents any rockets actually reaching to them. And I understand it must be super traumatic to be subject to those rockets coming in and the sounds of those rockets. And it must be very terrible for the Israeli families to live under that. But that entire strip is being bombarded with bombs and there's no dome protecting Palestinians. There's literally just families being blown apart overnight, which brings me to my next question. You know, even outside of the violence that's happening in this particular month, but including that, what is the current state that Palestinians are living under in Gaza and in West Bank?
Yeah, so that's another great question. So I defined the Nakba earlier as something that happened in the past in 1948. But really, in many ways, the Nakba is ongoing. And it's a phrase that you'll hear Palestinians say a lot, Nakba mustamirra, or the Nakba is ongoing. And what that means is that the current state of Palestinians throughout historic Palestine is dire. It's one of both fragmentation, political fragmentation, geographic fragmentation, as well as consistent violence. So Palestinians that are living in the Gaza Strip right now, even prior to the bombardment of the last 10 days or so, they were living under siege. They were living under economic blockade. They were living under severe constraints that limited and oftentimes eliminated just the dreams that young people have. Over half the population in the Gaza Strip is under the age of 30. And so these are young people, many of whom have lived almost their entire life under occupation under occupation their whole lives. But the young people have lived under the siege for many of them for most of their lives. Palestinians in the West Bank, depends on where they live. So the West Bank itself is fragmented into Bantustans. So there are some enclaves in the cities and towns of the West Bank that are nominally under the control of an authoritarian regime called the Palestinian Authority. And then Palestinians living in the rural areas are at the mercy of the Israeli military government. But even Palestinians living in towns and cities are still subject to Israeli oppression, because of checkpoints, because of military raids into their homes in the middle of the night, all kinds of things that make life miserable for them. And in both cases, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have a fragmented and ineffectual leadership. There's a third group of Palestinians that I want to also mention that don't get talked about often enough. They also happen to be the group that I study, and they are very fascinating right now, and I'll tell you why. And those are the Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. They're known as Palestinian citizens of Israel, or as 48 Palestinians, because they're in the area of Palestine that was conquered in 1948. They have nominal Israeli citizenship, but it's one of, you know, third class citizenship, essentially. They're discriminated against on many different levels, and I can come back another time and talk about it. So they too are fragmented because they've been told you're not Palestinian, you're Arab Israeli, you don't have nothing to do with the Palestinians. So when we talk about the current state, I've talked about the structural conditions, but what's really fascinating and gives me hope, as a matter of fact, is that the current state of mobilization among Palestinians living in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in East Jerusalem, and inside the 48 lines has been one of cooperation, has been one of unity, has been one of clarity of goal. And the goal they're all very clear about, which is liberation. So on May 18th, at very short notice, the entirety of the Palestinian population undertook a one-day strike. We've never seen that before, where everybody, regardless of geography, participated. So it's something to stay tuned for, and I think it's going to be a turning point.
Thank you for that. I mean, I 100% agree about, I would love to read your research about Palestinian citizens of Israel, because that truly gets to the heart of the claim that the Israel government is a democratic government that allots rights to its citizens. But it's quite obvious when you look at the Palestinian citizens of Israel that that's a farce. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that you say actually bring me to ask you about the word Palestinian itself, and some of the other words that we use when we talk about what's going on in Palestine. Why is it important to use the word Palestinian instead of Arab? Why is it important to use the word apartheid? Why is it important to see this as a human rights issue rather than a conflict between Jewish people and Muslim people?
All excellent questions. So let me take them one at a time. Why it's important to use, first, why it's important to use the word Palestinian instead of Arab. We often use them as historians, and I count myself as a historian. We often will refer to Palestinian Arabs, particularly in the pre-1948 period, as a way to say that Palestinians are part of the Arab people, right, as part of a larger kind of sense of Arab collective identity, but that we're not generically Arab. One of the major Israeli and Zionist claims that they said for a long time is, well, those Arabs are just Arabs and they can go anywhere. Why do they have to be here? They can just go to any other of the 22 Arab countries.
Right.
And that denies
a lot.
Right. And so that denies and erases the very specific and very personal and very localized connections and very deep rooted connections that people have, that Palestinians have to their land. So I'm a Palestinian American born and raised in the US. If I meet another Palestinian anywhere else in the world and they find out I'm Palestinian, they want to know where in Palestine I come from. Now, mm-hmm. My parents were both born in Palestine, but they both became refugees in 1948 as children. So we are now two generations, one and a half generations removed from Palestine. But I can tell you exactly where my mother was from, where my father was from. So it's a way of meaning making, and it's also a way of asserting and emphasizing that Palestinians are tied to that specific land in Palestine. And you can also tell by people's last names. You can tell by the specific Arabic dialect that they speak with. So it's very, very localized. So saying just Arab erases that cultural and national distinctiveness. And it also plays into Zionist claims that these Palestinians are just like random, generic, can go anywhere. In terms of apartheid, the word apartheid is important to use. And we're seeing it used increasingly now in order to make sense of and to clarify the picture about what it is that Palestinians are facing. You asked me a few minutes ago about Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and I told you about the ones inside Israel as well. And the Israeli government is really good, frankly, like diabolically good, at creating bureaucratic fog that makes it really difficult to explain in a very concise way all the different ways that Palestinians are discriminated against. But what the Human Rights Watch report did, the Human Rights Watch report that came out last month in April, it's called A Threshold Crossed. What it does there is that it breaks through the fog and shines a light that sort of clears the fog and says, despite all the bureaucratic niceties and despite all of the clinical terminology and despite the facade of a semi-independent Palestinian authority, ultimately, at the end of the day, Israel controls all of the people living between the river and the sea and has two different sets of laws based on your ethnicity or ethno-national identity. And that's apartheid. That meets the legal definition of apartheid. It looks different than how it looked in South Africa, but the principle of differentiating legally, politically, economically, between two sets of people based on their ethno-religious identity, that is apartheid. So it essentially breaks through all the clinical and all the jargony and all the bureaucratic language. So that's why it's important to use the word apartheid. Some Palestinian analysts will say even apartheid doesn't go far enough, because apartheid is the means through which Israeli settler colonialism is being implemented on the ground. Settler colonialism means, we know colonialism is the idea of controlling and extracting resources from the land. Settler colonialism aims to displace the native inhabitants of that land and replace them with settlers. So it's different than, say, British colonialism in India, for example, where the British were mostly using local labor. So settler colonialism aims to displace the native population and replace them with the settler population. So that's at the heart of the Israeli Zionist project. And apartheid is the means to do so. The last term of human rights actually ties into this. So if we understand the Zionist Israeli project as one of settler colonialism that enacts apartheid against the Palestinian population, and if we remember our own Islamic history that allowed for and welcomed Muslims, Christians, and Jews to live and worship in the Holy Land, then it becomes obvious that this is a human rights issue rather than an issue of religious conflict. Religious terminology is sometimes used and invoked, but at the heart of it, it's a cause for justice, for freedom, and to get back to the heart of what Palestine should be. Palestine is a holy land for Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and therefore Muslims, Christians, and Jews ought to be able to live there with full dignity, with full rights, and with a full ability to express their attachment to the land.
Couldn't agree more. There is, I think, a lot of people who are not familiar with Judaism and Islam perhaps don't realize how much similarity there is between Judaism and Islam. Yeah. A lot of the ways that we do our rituals and practices, they're so identical to one another. It really surprises Christians or people who just don't know about the two religions that, hey, we literally have identical rituals and practices. And I do want to also comment that before we wrap up, that people who are fighting for the liberation and freedom of Palestine routinely condemn any threats of anti-Semitism that arise within or outside of the movement itself. And I see this condemnation all the time. It doesn't get as much coverage as it ought to, but I think for people who are fighting for liberation of Palestine as a human rights issue, they do see that any hatred towards Jewish people is reprehensible, and it's antithetical to the values of Islam. It's to the antithetical to the values of humanity and of morality. And on the flip side, there are many Christians and Jews and Muslims who condemn the apartheid in Palestine and join hands together to fight for the liberation of all, from Ferguson all the way to Palestine. So 100%, this is not a religious conflict of any kind. It is a human rights issue where human rights violations are taking place, where colonization and apartheid are taking place. And we are not just simply standing by, but we're facilitating it through our tax dollars. I remember when Obama's presidency was ending, we signed one of the biggest military aid deals to Netanyahu. And even right now, Biden has a very massive amount that he wants to pass for military aid yet again. So we're not just standing by, but we're completely complicit as Americans in the sense that our tax dollars are going to the oppression of Palestinian people, and which makes it even more so important as Americans for us to make this an American issue. Like, hey, this is not where we want our tax dollar to go to.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Maha. I really appreciate all the history that you gave and how you framed the issue. I think it's really important for people to be able to see this as a issue of oppression rather than the way that is often presented in this Islamophobic manner, that, you know, there are just some people who don't like each other, mm-hmm. Which is not what is happening here at all.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Saba, for having me on. I really appreciated the conversation and your really excellent questions. And I hope we can meet again.
Definitely, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.